Hello and welcome to the Migration Oxford podcast. I'm Jackie Broadhead.
And I'm Rob McNeil.
Rob, what are we talking about today?
So what we're talking about today is Christian missionary work, mapping Christian missionary work in a very specific part of India, so in the northeast of India. And even more specifically, really, we're focusing primarily on the state of Mizoram and also on the state of Nagaland as well. And we're speaking to three extraordinary experts about their various and very different work, looking at the role of Christian missionary work and the kind of emergence of Christianity within the cultures of those areas.
Yeah, the absolute joy of this podcast is, I think, firstly, the privilege of kind of seeing the breadth of migration research here at Oxford, but also the kind of opportunity to learn about topics that you have absolutely no kind of prior knowledge of, which I think is the case for both of us in this particular example, but so incredibly interesting. And for me, I think one of the things that's so interesting is how this idea of kind of missionary work as emigration, and obviously through kind of a complete colonial lens, but then the way that that's been reshaped, reinterpreted, kind of reclaimed, reowned by the communities in these places, and it kind of really belongs to them and shapes their idea of identity and belonging outside of kind of that single kind of arrival in, I think, the 1870s of particular kind of missionaries.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And there's a sort of weird thing for me in this personally, insofar as my background initially was in archaeology. And one of the things that I was always really interested in that I studied in my bachelor's degree on archaeology was the spread of Roman culture. And one of the things the Romans did very well was to actually accommodate the gods of the areas where they would turn up, right? So they'd turn up in Britain and there'd be some water god or whatever, and the Romans would accommodate that god into their pantheon. And commonly, actually, you would have gods that would make their way into the kind of Roman culture. And it was very interesting to me to hear particularly about how Christianity in Nagaland in particular had become something which had adopted a lot of the concepts of the existing animist religions that had been there and had become this very specific, very particular interpretation of Christianity that existed really in that place as a part of that culture, and that accommodated all of the history and the past of the place without just kind of steamrolling it and having a kind of year zero where Christianity began. All of the stuff that was existing there became part of the new imagination of what this community became. And I thought that was a really fascinating way of looking at something which we tend to look at in very black and white terms. You know, colonial religion is imposed on people and they're forced to operate in a particular way. But then there's this situation where a community evolves with something new. And I think that's a really interesting way of looking at things. I found the whole conversation really, really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it made me reflect a little bit on kind of the different types of migration that we have been sort of covering within this podcast. So obviously, we think about the mobility of people and have some discussion in this about the position of these particular areas, you know, the fact that they're borderlands and the fact that they feel quite distant from mainland India and the effect that that has on, you know, on how you feel and kind of your identity. But also, I think, you know, we looked on our episode on remittances about kind of migration as the movement of money, and now thinking about kind of migration as the movement of ideas and this kind of wider sense of how we think about the kind of impacts of migration through all these different lenses and perspectives.
Absolutely. It's not just the movement, but the sort of the adoption of ideas, you know, the changes in people as a result of encountering new concepts, new ideas, new things. You know, and we take it for granted that Britain has changed as a result of different religions and different foods and all the other things that shift the way that a nation functions. And of course, it's natural to think to realize that the cultures and ideas that have been exported through the colonial period, through all kinds of other situations, will take root, but that they will also become part of those communities, as opposed to simply being things that are remote. And I think that it's helpful to see it in those ways. It's also helpful to really engage with the realities of geographies that we don't think about that much here, right? I mean, Mizoram, for those who are listening who know all of the details about the location of the state of Mizoram, I didn't realize where it was, this place between essentially Myanmar, Burma, whatever we should call it, and Bangladesh, which, you know, so you've got a Buddhist state on one side, you've got a Muslim state on the other side, and sandwiched between the two of them is a Christian sort of exclave, or whatever you want to call it, which is in itself, you know, a fascinating realization about the geography of that region.
And I think, you know, given that we both freely admit our kind of ignorance in this area, it seems like we should get as quickly as possible over to the experts.
I'm joined by Dr. Tiatemsu Longkumar, who's in the anthropology department at the Royal Thimphu College in Bhutan. Dr. Zaza Sanga Pacharao, who is in the politics department at the Government Serchip College in Mizoram in India. And by Shivangi Kauchik, who is a PhD student at Oxford's Department for International Development. Let me start with you, Shivangi, if that's okay. I mean, your work explores the intersection of youth, mobility and Christianity in northeast India. So could you give me a brief overview of what we're sort of trying to get to grips with today?
Firstly, thank you, everyone. Basically, directly, I would want to jump into why the three of us have come together for this episode. We agree that migration is not an isolated process. We come from communities and states of the region. And through our work and our experience, we have figured out there are three very major important institutions or paradigms that very much shape how migration is experienced by different individuals. And these three paradigms are religion, community, and identity. And the two speakers in the context of Nagaland and Mizoram, two distinct states of the region, are going to elaborate a little bit on the overlaps between these three paradigms. But from my own experience as an ethnographer, when I was working with a few migrant students in Delhi, I was made aware of, you know, how ancestors and forefathers came together to redefine community identities back home in the region. And that very much builds on genealogies, colonial genealogies of having acquired missionary education, and how Christianity came together as a religion to sort of, you know, redefine different modes of identity. And this was happening somewhere in different stages, but it sort of confluenced, or it sort of came together when India was gaining independence somewhere around 1947, when, you know, communities started mobilizing for different aspirations or different alternative aspirations for homelands. And these aspirations are honored and commemorated back in the center, which is Delhi. And because of the overlap of community, identity, and religion, the frontier sort of, you know, as it were, the frontier sort of travels with, you know, people from the region as they travel to different parts of the country. It's not just education or employment or reasons of economic mobility that drives or that shapes migration, especially pertaining to different individuals, communities, and states of the region. But it also has to do with how the very idea of a frontier travels with them. And there has been certain studies done by Madiha Tahir and Nosheen Ali in the context of Pakistan, when she talks about how stigma of coming from a certain borderland of Pakistan travels with people from borderlands as they try to make their lives in a different part. But having said that, this is also a frontier which has its own positioned itself in different ways with different forms of governance. And those relationships and positionalities have not always been friendly. So missionary education, Christianity, and civil society organizations shaped that community identity, which influences or impinges on migrant subjectivities of young people.
So Zaza Sanga, as Shivangi has rightly identified, I mean, these are important regional sort of spaces. And I have to confess my just general ignorance and ask for your general forgiveness about this. So I know very little about the state of Mizoram other than its geographic location, and probably the state that it's most physically remote from the Republic of India. So from that sort of complex geographical starting point, it seems likely that even more complex questions of group identity and nationhood are inevitably going to emerge. So am I right in thinking that? Is that correct? And what role does migration, youth, religious movements and all of these other frontiers that Shivangi has been talking about play in that?
Yes, Rob, thank you for the question. It's an interesting question, I think. And first of all, I fully understand the lack of your knowledge about Mizoram, because even some of our fellow citizens in mainland India still didn't know that Mizoram is a part of India today also. As you have stated, Mizoram is located at a remote location in the northeastern part of India. And the fact that the culture, the language, the social structure and most of the things that the society holds dearly to it are quite distinct, are quite different from those that are there in the societies and cultures in mainland India. So the first thing regarding the Mizo mindset, the Mizo psyche, is that there is a tendency to ask a question about us and others. Us in the sense that us will be the Mizos and the others will be those non-Mizos who are residing in the mainland India. So that is still embedded strongly in the Mizo psyche today. And secondly, what I would like to emphasize is the role that religion plays in the Mizo society. I think its religion is the one that transforms Mizo society in all its aspects. We can safely say that it is religion that makes the Mizo society what it is today. We have been a Christian dominated state for the past 130 years or so. So for the Mizos, a non-Christian resident of the state, that means a non-Christian resident in Mizoram, is like a far off stranger for us in the Mizo mindset. And rather than a non-Christian, non-Mizo resident, a Christian non-Mizo in other parts of the state feels like a distant brother or sister. That is the extent of how religion and religious affiliation occupies an important place in Mizo society. And a testament to that fact will be the existence of peace for over 40 years after the signing of the peace accord back in 1986. Since 1966, Mizoram was hampered by the Mizo independence movement, but after the signing of the peace accord, no further violences have been taking place in Mizoram till date. So that, I think, is a testament of how community feeling and how the belongingness, the homogeneity of the Mizo society and culture contributes to the lasting peace in Mizoram. And thirdly, it is somewhat like a societal norm for any Mizo youth to be a member of a statewide organization. There are so many youth organizations and women organizations, church organizations, civil society organizations in the state. It doesn't matter whether they're active members or they are inactive members. It has somewhat become a societal requirement for any Mizo youth to be a member in any one of these organizations. And I think it is an interesting coincidence that the first youth organization ever to be established in Mizoram is also established by the Christian missionaries themselves. So we can say that religion is the harbinger of the youth movements and youth activities in Mizoram. And lastly, although early Mizo historical writings regarding the origin of the Mizos are lacking, one thing that we can establish as a fact is that we, the Mizos, are an ethnic migrant group. We are an ethnic migrant group who have migrated somewhere from East and Central Asia some 200, 300 years back and have settled to where we are now in Mizoram today. The thing is that migrations and displacements, particularly due to colonial administration, like demarcation of state boundaries and ethnic violences, have placed many Mizo ethnic tribes outside Mizoram, particularly in Manipur, in Assam, in Arunachal Pradesh, in Tripura, and in Bangladesh and Myanmar as well. So what ties these ethnic Mizo tribes across state and international borders is, I think, first of all, is their common ancestry. We all share the common ancestry. We all share similar cultures. We all share similar traditions. And the most important thing is our feeling of belongingness to a particular community, that is the Mizo community. So it is here that I think migration plays a vital role in the formation of group identity and perception of Mizo nation and sentiment as a whole. So we may be residing in Myanmar, we may be residing in Tripura, we may not be within Mizoram itself, but it doesn't matter because all Mizos have an affinity to that particular nomenclature known as Mizo community.
That's fantastic. Really, really interesting. So, Tia Temsu, you also look at the role of Christianity, but in this case, Christian missionary work and community building in a very specific group in another remote part of Northeast India, which is the, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Awl Indigenous Community in Nagaland. Now, I mean, I tend to look at Christianity in India as a somewhat imposed remnant of the colonial era. But your analysis looks at it in a more nuanced way, I think. And so can you explain a bit what you mean, firstly, by immanent religious beliefs, which I think is part of what you study, and how that relates to the adoption of Christianity in the Awl community in Nagaland?
Yeah, that's really interesting. You see, when we talk about Christianity in Nagaland itself, I mean, it came in the year 1872. Dr. E.W. Clerk kind of was the first missionary. And when you look at Nagaland today, then according to the population, I mean, in any place of the world, we have the highest percentage of Baptist Christians in the Nagaland as such. I mean, if you look at the population of the Nagaland percentages accordingly. And that's quite interesting because when you look at how Christianity itself came about, I mean, there are a lot of historical junctures into these aspects, but I'll not go into this. But one of the way by which E.W. Clerk kind of reached Nagaland was through one of the Assamese missionary, the state nearby Nagaland, right? So he reached the Awl Nagas. And one of the interesting thing aspect about that also has to do with how, you know, the missionaries in that sense kind of considered what places really are, because one of the way by which they considered the kind of native places were that, okay, these were places which were inhibited by the evil spirit as such. And so they wanted to eradicate that aspect. And in order to do that, you know, one of the things that they wanted to do was this aspect that they want to actually establish a kind of place where Christians reside in that sense, and where Christian light emanate to the other villages as such. And obviously people have called that kind of place as called as, you know, Christian missionary station, something like that, right? When I talk about this aspect of immanence as such, and there was, you know, indigenous religion that already existed among the Awl Nagas, which I conceptualize as animism through the perspective of new animism, right? So it's part of the whole rubric of, or the aspect of animism as such. I just put in some of the new work that is there in animism in different fields of study. Now, when I look at the immanent aspect of it, I'm also talking about how the native people, the Awl Nagas, interpreted Christianity as such. And the thing that I am kind of pointing towards is that, okay, they interpreted Christianity from a lens from where how they understood the world as. And they understood or they interacted the world through the animistic perspective in that sense. And this is where the way they adopted Christianity in that sense has that element, their own native element that is there in Christianity. And that is something which I point out to in terms of the imminence of, you know, making Christianity native to the people itself. And that is where, when we say Christianity as such, the Christians as such, and the way the belief practice it is somewhat very much different from, obviously, what we would call as Christianity in general, or Christianity in the text as such, in the Bible as such, right? The interplay of this is something which is very important in terms of the people and the community. The idea of God is something which obviously, in terms of the native language, the idea of God do not exist. And one of the word by which they actually use, or the word that they use to actually signify the Christian God, is called Tsangram. Now, Tsangram is a native word, actually, which they actually use to actually signify those spiritual beings, right? The other beings that were there. And by looking at this aspect, you know, when you look at the people as such, you know, their life has been constructed, their society has been constructed around this aspect that, you know, you actually see spilling off in their everyday political life. And this is where one of the ideas that I talk about is this idea of Nagaland for Christ, you know, Nagaland, a place, a boundary, a state, which actually talks about it as an aspect, a significant aspect of which actually, you know, kind of moves towards this aspect that, okay, this place or this geography is something which is for Christ, Jesus Christ. And when you look at this aspect, this Nagaland for Christ obviously came about during the 1950s when there were actually Naga movement emerging, different kinds of sects of Naga movement that were emerging. And so people kind of took this Nagaland for Christ, firstly, to the mean that, okay, the Nagaland as a state or as a boundary, as a place, is actually meant for Christians, and we are against any kind of other forms of religion or any other forms of idea as such. Another thing that it asserts is also this aspect that, okay, since we are Christians, and one of the things that we do is also that we continue to emanate our presence among all the other neighboring states or places that are there around the world. And one of the things there here in Nagaland for Christ that the people, the Christians, and they talk about is, because when we talk about Nagaland for Christ, this is not a movement which is only for the Christian community as such, or people who are in the church or the pastors as such, but this is also a movement of the national leaders themselves in that sense. And this is where they talk about this idea that, okay, when we talk about Nagaland for Christ, it also asserts this idea that, you know, when we talk about the political realm as such and how we decide the political aspect in this state itself is actually being detected by the Christian faith that we kind of believe and adhere to. And this is how, when we look at historically, you know, during the post-independence and after independence, you know, this idea kind of seemed to kind of emerge. And this is where, you know, the idea of missionaries comes into the picture.
Thank you so much. That's a very comprehensive and very interesting answer. Shivangi, just coming back to you, I mean, you obviously began by talking about your experiences in Delhi, and we've been talking about internal migrations here as just as complex and politically fraught as international migration. And we're also looking at what many people would perceive to be a kind of colonial tool of the exercise of power, rather, Christianity, as a sort of grassroots community building movement. So I kind of feel like we're messing with a lot of people in the UK's anyway, preconceived perceptions of migration and identity here. How do you think that helps or hinders an understanding of contemporary India?
So what I think we have been trying to talk, also to a certain extent deconstruct or understand the term migrant itself and how it sort of works with different subjectivities of different people from different parts of the region. Now, I think to a great extent, one of the things that I wanted to also talk about was remembrance and commemoration. After staying in another completely different city, when I was, talking to young people, was that I came across certain missionary leaders who had actually gone to the southern, present-day southern Manipur hills and Lushai hills. And these were parts of the region way back before the 1950s. And this is a map that has now changed because a lot of communities and a lot of movements, now they have their own states. But there was, like, through archival research, I came across a missionary, and his name was Rochunga Pudaite, and he wrote letters to the Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, asking for recognition, right? And then there were different officials and different secretaries who were working with the state departments then, who said that, you know, there is this British ethnographer or administrator, J.S. Shakespeare, who has done this classification of communities, and your community is not recognized as a separate community there, so you don't need recognition. So those sort of hierarchies of recognition which existed in colonial times, and those were something that were impinging on, you know, young people who collaborated with me. When we talk about migration, I think that what it definitely does is that it highlights the nuances that emerges as a result of the overlap between these institutions, that we don't see migration as an isolated process. And when it comes to talking about larger politics in India today, I feel that to a certain extent, it's a very risky thing to do because you never know actually how people perceive it. But the discourse that is there, you know, I feel to a great extent, it's very much mediated by what communities think of themselves in relation to other communities with whom they may have contiguous land, and there have, you know, emerged issues and contentions, and now they are asking for different forms of identification. And of course, as the speakers have already said, in different eras, both colonial and missionary movements have had different roles to play, and then consequently you also have parallel political movements. So I would say that migration, to a certain extent, and how individuals whose communities have lived those movements, migration helps you to recount them or to revisit them, because it's always in memory. This conversation, I think, is very much influenced by that interplay, you know, between memory, migration, and between how the institutions of community, identity, religion work back home.
Super interesting. Zaza Sangha, can you tell us a bit about what the history of religious movements in Northeast India actually tells us about the sort of the present and arguably, I mean, if you can tell us anything about what you think the future of the region might be, and how much of a role does migration play in that whole process?
What we have to keep in mind, first of all, is that the northeastern part of India is a region which is characterized by diverse cultures, ethnicities, and religious faiths. So I don't think that I can point out a particular religious movement that could shape the course and future of the region as a whole. But because each state has a majority population that professes certain beliefs and faiths, religious faiths. At the same time, as I have said, with regards to Mizoram, religion and religious movements have played a vital role in identity formation in most of the northeastern states. Having said that, I think it would not be wrong to say that all major religions have made incursions into the northeast. So let's take the example of my home state, Mizoram. We used to say that the Mizos are 100% Christian. But judging from the statistics that we see from the latest 2021 census published by the government of India, 86% of the population in Mizoram are Christians, while there are 14% who are professing other faiths and religions. So I think from that simple statistics alone, what we can see is that 14% other religious faiths are made up of migrants who migrated and came to Mizoram for various purposes. So I think it would be fair to assume that each of the northeastern states have a sizable population who profess religions and various religious faiths, even though they are the minority in the states that they are residing. And besides, an interesting observation that one can make regarding the northeastern states from a religious viewpoint is that religious violence or clashes have seldom occurred in the history of the northeastern region. Religious harmony and interfaith understanding is one of the remarkable hallmarks of the northeastern states. In the future also, this interfaith harmony and interfaith understanding would still persist if this smooth flow and internalization of this migration continues in each of the northeastern states.
I mean, this brings me back to you, Tiatemsu. We were talking about, you know, the emergence of Christianity among the Ao community. To what extent does your work reveal sameness or difference within the teachings of traditional indigenous religions among the Ao people and the sort of Christian Baptist teachings that many have adopted? What do you think that tells us about cultures, change and identity more broadly?
One of the thing about teaching as such, and one of the thing that I want to try to uncover is, okay, what is the method by which they went on, the missionaries in that sense, right? Early missionaries, when they come, they went on evangelizing the native people there in Nagaland. And one of the thing that I continue to kind of looked at is these literatures where, okay, what were the kind of education that the missionaries were going through during the time? And there were a lot of what they call us the mission methodology in that sense of how to evangelize in that sense, right? To different communities. But one of the things that I kind of found out was when the missionary, and specifically when I talk about E.W. Clark, when E.W. Clark came to Nagaland and saw the native people in that sense, I believe he had a kind of change in mind as to how do I kind of interact with these people and, you know, bring this Christianity, the gospel to the people in that sense. Because the missionary who came later on after E.W. Clark, Haggard and Perrin, they were two of the missionary family that came. And these people had a really a different perspective as to saying that, you know, the native people in that sense, their belief and practices which is attached to animism should not be actually practiced anymore. And E.W. Clark had a very different perspective in that sense, because E.W. Clark has a certain, had certain leniency as to, okay, what can they practice, what can they do, what can they not do. And one of the things that they continued to talk about was this usage of rice beer, you know, the alcohol that is made through rice, right, fermented rice. And Haggard and Perrin was not really, they said that, okay, as Christians, you do not do this, right? You don't drink this. I mean, being asked, but one of the way by which you identify as Christian is you give away this aspect. E.W. Clark didn't think of that like that. So there are many other aspects that were there, which were actually different in terms of how the missionaries who came to Nagaland themselves perceive what you need to give up, the cultural aspect that you need to give up to be able to be a Christian as such. In terms of teachings as such and the similarities and differences that we talk about, you see, one of the things by which the Christians, by which native Aonagas in that sense, kind of were attracted to Christians were not so much of preaching as such. It was through singing, you know. Songs were one of the things by which they were very much attracted to. Another aspect has to do with when Christians come together, then, you know, they saw that, okay, they were actually gathering and they were actually doing these prayers. Everyone were sounding some sounds together, you know, and it's like, sounds like a gibberish sound as we're coming out, people crying, people praying. And that was also something which was really interesting to people, as to people coming together and then just closing their eyes and praying. And, you know, this meditative process was really interesting to them. So initially onwards, it was not the kind of systematic teaching or doctrinal teachings or anything as such, but it was through certain cultural aspect which they found affinity towards, right? The which the missionaries brought by. And that was an interesting aspect when you look at it historically.
I don't have as much of theological knowledge as the Atimsa and Zara sir, but one thing that I would definitely add is that I have also seen a lot of changes, because there's been changes in terms of urbanization, introduction of social media. In my case, young people have moved around for different aspirational goals. Community is something that they live through it subjectively at an individual level. But what I'm trying to basically, what we are trying to basically say is that if we are to look at migration in the context of the region, then I think we are just trying to, you know, start a conversation on regional similarities or commonalities that are common factors that one can consider while talking about the region. And one more thing that I would add is that, yes, when it comes to talking about any of these processes, there will be changes as per the individual. And this is something that both Sara sir talked about in terms of community, and Tia Tamsu talked about in terms of indigenous Christianity. So we are not trying to set a template for understanding these processes in terms of the region. I think we are just trying to have a conversation as per our research, our lived experiences. And we would be happy to engage with these themes in the future. And I do thank everyone for engaging with my pitch and for giving us the space. And thank you so much, Rob, for the wonderful conversation, and to Delphine for the technical help, and Jacqueline for being there for us. And also Jacqueline is the one who pushed me to think about migrant, the idea of what it means to be a migrant. And that's how I actually started engaging with the work of both Zara sir and Tia Tamsu Longkumer. So having this conversation with both of them is my privilege. Thank you all.
You've been listening to the Migration Oxford podcast. I'm Jackie Broadhead.
And I'm Rob McNeil.